Lake Bindu Sarovara was adorned by flowering trees such as Kadamba, Champaka, Ashoka, Karanja, Bakula, Asana, Kunda, Mandara, Kutaja, and young mango trees. The air was filled with the pleasing notes of Karandava ducks, flavas, swans, ospreys, waterfowl, cranes, chakravakas, and chakoras. For most of the trees, flowers, fruits, and birds mentioned here as surrounding Bindu Sarovara Lake, English synonyms cannot be found. All the trees mentioned are very pious in that they produce a nice aromatic flower, such as the champaka, kadamba, and bakula. The sweet sounds of waterfowl and cranes made the surrounding area as pleasant as possible and created a very suitable spiritual atmosphere. So I will read the next text also, which deals with the fauna. Its shores abounded with deer, boars, porcupines, gavayas, elephants, baboons, lions, monkeys, mongooses, and musk deer. Report by Srila Prabhupada. Musk deer are not found in every forest, but only in places like Bindu Sarovara. They are always intoxicated by the aroma of musk secreted from their navels. Gavayas, the species of cow mentioned herein, bear a bunch of hair at the end of their tails. This bunch of hair is used in temple worship to fan the deities. Gavayas are sometimes called chamaris, and they are considered very sacred. In India, there are still gypsies or forest mercantile people who flourish by trading kasturi or musk and the bunches of hair from the chamaris. They are always in great demand for the higher classes of Hindu population, and such business still goes on in the large cities and villages in India. Texts 45 through 47. Entering that most sacred spot with his daughter and going near the sage, the first monarch, Svayambhuva Manu, saw the sage sitting in his hermitage, having just propitiated the sacred fire by pouring oblations into it. His body shone most brilliantly. Though he had engaged in austere penance for a long time, he was not emaciated, for the Lord had cast his affectionate sidelong glance upon him, and he had also heard the nectar flowing from the moon-like words of the Lord. The sage was tall, his eyes were large, like the petals of a lotus, and he had matted locks on his head. He was clad in rags. Svayambhuva Manu approached and saw him to be somewhat soiled, like an unpolished gem. Purport by Srila Prabhupada. Here are some descriptions of a brahmachari yogi. In the morning, the first duty of a brahmachari seeking spiritual elevation is hutahutashana, to offer sacrificial oblations to the Supreme Lord. Those engaged in brahmacharya cannot sleep until 7 or 9 o'clock in the morning. They must rise early in the morning, or at least 1.5 hours before the sun rises, and offer oblations. Or in this age, they must chant the holy name of the Lord, Hare Krishna. As referred to by Lord Chaitanya, kalo nastyeva 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 gatir anyata. There is no other alternative in this age to chanting the holy name of the Lord. The brahmachari must rise early in the morning, and after placing himself, he should chant the holy name of the Lord. From the very features of the sage, it appeared that he had undergone great austerities. That is the sign of one observing brahmacharya, the vow of celibacy. If one lives otherwise, it will be manifest in the lust visible in his face and body. The word vidyotamanam indicates that the brahmachari feature showed in his body. That is the certificate that one has undergone great austerity in yoga. A drunkard or smoker or sexmonger can never be eligible to practice yoga. Generally, yogis look very skinny because of their not being comfortably situated. But Kardama Muni was not emaciated, for he had seen the Supreme Personality of Godhead face to face. Here the word snigdhapanga valokanat means that he was fortunate enough to see the Supreme Lord face to face. He looked healthy because he had directly received the nectarian sound vibrations from the lotus lips of the personality of Godhead. Similarly, one who hears the transcendental sound vibration of the holy name of the Lord, Hare Krishna, also improves in health. We have actually seen that many brahmacharis and grihasthas connected with the International Society for Krishna Consciousness have improved in health, and a luster has come to their faces. It is essential that a brahmachari engaged in spiritual advancement look very healthy and lustrous. The comparison of the sage to an unpolished gem is very appropriate. Even if a gem just taken from a mine looks unpolished, the luster of the gem cannot be stopped. Similarly, although Kardama was not properly dressed and his body was not properly cleansed, his overall appearance was gem-like.
So, well,
so we have Svayambhuva Manu going to see Kardama Muni. One thing to comment regarding the previous two verses is that this is one area in the Bhagavatam that creates a problem for the modern scientific people, because it refers to all of these modern plants and animals surrounding Lake Bindu Sarovara. There aren't English translations for a lot of these trees and so forth, but they currently grow in India. So, in fact, you can see them there. A lot of them are involved in Krishna's pastimes in Vrindavan, as a matter of fact. And also the animals are mammals of the modern type. So this event took place approximately 1.97 billion years ago. You can calculate that on the basis of information given in the Bhagavatam, namely that this occurred during the period of Svayambhuva Manu, and six Manvantar periods have fully elapsed, and we are in the, 27 Yuga cycles of the seventh Manvantar period have elapsed, and we're in the Kali Yuga of the 28th Yuga cycle. And we're just about 5,000 years into that Kali Yuga. So based on that, you can calculate when the Svayambhuva Manu period began. So that comes out to about 1.97 billion years. Because the length of one Manvantar period is about 307 million years. So this occurred quite a long time ago. And according to modern scientific ideas, all these plants and animals weren't existing then. So that's a whole question which one can look into. I'll just mention briefly that the modern scientific view of things is based on the principle of uniformitarianism. Now that principle says that everything can be extrapolated on the basis of what we see. In other words, by seeing what things are like in our own vicinity and environment, we can understand what is true at a very great distance from us, both in space and in time. So the idea of uniformitarianism, actually the term was first created by geologists in England, actually, in the 19th century. In fact, it was people in England in the 19th century who created this whole problem. They really worked hard, too. Drew Dharma just handed me a book this thick about some of their endeavors. So the idea of uniformitarianism is that everything in nature is going on according to the processes that we see today. So as when it comes to explaining geological formations and so forth, these all can be explained in terms of the wind and the rain and so forth as we see it, flowing water, eroding rocks, and so on. So on that basis, they determine a picture of what was going on in the past. They extrapolate things backwards. So I just saw some interesting examples to which you could try to apply that. I was in Boulder, Colorado. So right next to the preaching center there, you can see a mountain which has slabs of rock which were once horizontal because they're sedimentary rock, but they're tilted up at an angle like this. In fact, next to that, there's another one where the rock is actually vertical, but it used to be completely horizontal. Now, you might ask, how did that come about? So I suppose one idea is that a large number of tiny little earthquakes may have done it. With each one, it just tilted slightly and then gradually got into that position. Anyway, it's a curious geological formation. I also looked at it from the airplane on the way back here, and you could see that there's a very long ridge of earth in which the sediment has been completely tilted up like that, and it's unique. I looked carefully at the mountains across the whole Rocky Mountain range on the way back, and that was the only instance I saw of anything that looked like that. All the other mountains are different in structure. But there, for some reason, the rock has been tilted up like this. So one might ask how that happened. So basically this idea of extrapolation from what we can directly see is applied by the scientists. And they would have to somehow explain that. I'd be interested in hearing their explanation. Probably they don't have one. The thing that generally you do is just wave your hands and say that some general explanation applies. So, here we have this description of Lake Bindusarovara, and it is different from what the scientists would say was there at that time. It is more different than one might think, though. So one principle that can be considered when it comes to explaining the Srimad Bhagavatam is that things are more different from what we're accustomed to thinking than we would expect. In other words, the solution to the problems is not to, let us say, reduce the extraordinary nature of the claims that are made in the Bhagavatam, but rather to fully confront the extraordinary claims that are being made there. So the Bhagavatam is saying that the sage Kardama Muni was sitting by this lake, Bindusarovara. Now it's explained somewhere here that Bindusarovara means that this lake was produced by the, or at least was affected by the tears of Lord Vishnu. Previously, it's described that Kardama Muni was sitting by this lake meditating, and he had been doing so for very many years. This was during the Satya Yuga. And people at that time used to live for 100,000 years. So that's, first of all, a point that's relevant to this question of extrapolation, because one wouldn't expect that people were living for 100,000 years. So during that time, yogis could meditate for very long periods of time without eating. In fact, they would just sit in one place, control the life airs within the body, and engage entirely in meditation of different types. Some of them were impersonalists, of course, but the actual standard for meditation was to meditate on the form of Lord Vishnu. So Kardama Muni was that type of yogi, and after meditating for an extraordinarily long period of time, Lord Vishnu himself came before him. So there's a whole series of verses that we were reading previously in which that was described. So Lord Vishnu was very compassionate upon seeing Kardama Muni, and so he actually cried upon seeing him. So some tears from his eyes fell into that lake. So that's what the name of the lake actually means. I think Bindu is a tear. Yeah. So Bindu Sarovara. So that's the lake that Lord Vishnu's tears fell into. Srila Prabhupada said in some purport near here that this meant that Lake Bindu Sarovara was similar in potency to the Ganges, because in fact the Ganges comes from the feet of Lord Vishnu. So this is a similar thing. Now, as it turns out, the river Saraswati, this lake was next to the river Saraswati, but the whole river has vanished, as I mentioned in the previous class that I gave. So all kinds of changes take place over time. So at this time, Kardama Muni was sitting there meditating, but he is directly a son of Brahma. Also, the Svayambhuva Manu is directly a son of Brahma. And Svayambhuva Manu was residing in the city of Barhishmati in Brahmavarta. I mentioned in the previous class that there is some controversy that Srila Prabhupada mentions regarding where Brahmavarta was situated. So some were saying that Brahmavarta is on the earth, and it would be in the region between the Ganges and the Jamuna River. That's where Brahmavarta would be located. And others were saying that it's a place in Brahmaloka. So I was mentioning that there are all kinds of connections between celestial places and earthly places, according to the Bhagavatam. So Svayambhuva Manu was residing on the earth, but the earth that he was presiding over was more than just the earth that we know of also. Specifically, later on, his sons and grandsons became kings of various regions in Bhumandala. In particular, one son of Svayambhuva Manu was King Priyavrata. The story of Priyavrata is that he had renounced material life entirely and had become a disciple of Narada Muni. So he was practicing brahmacharya and was meditating out in the Gandhamadana mountain, I believe it was. That is located in Jambudweep, in a certain location. So Svayambhuva Manu wanted to retire from his position of ruling the earth. And so it was appropriate for his son Priyavrata to take over that position. But his Priyavrata didn't want to do so. So finally Brahma himself had to come down and speak to Narada Muni and Priyavrata to convince them that Priyavrata should give up his spiritual practices, at least temporarily, and take up the position of king. So Priyavrata, of course, agreed to do that, being asked by Brahma himself, who is his grandfather, actually. So he became the king, and he ruled for 11 arbudas of years. So an arbuda is, I believe, 100 million years. So that means that Priyavrata ruled for 1.1 billion years, which is even longer than the period of Amanu. And apparently he was ruling a good part of the universe. Srila Prabhupada said that it wasn't clear exactly where he was situated. So this was a son of Svayambhuva Manu who was had his capital in Brahmavarta on the earth. So I'm bringing this up to make this point concerning uniformitarianism and extrapolation. Evidently, things were quite different then from the way they are now. So also, even the sequence of historical events as described in the Bhagavatam was following a somewhat different pattern at that time, because this Priyavrata was ruling for a period of several manvantars, actually. So, as it turns out, after that period of time, Priyavrata, Maharaj Priyavrata, became slightly attached to his wife. Now consider that. It took him 1.1 billion years to become slightly attached to his wife. And when he realized that this was happening, he then renounced material life again and took up his original spiritual activities. So it seems he was a little bit steady in his determination. Also, Maharaj Priyavrata, there are other interesting things about him. He created the seven oceans, and hence the seven islands that are described in the description of Bhumandala. So he did this on one occasion where he decided to create a second sun in order to provide pleasing conditions for the people. So what he did was ride in his chariot, which was very effulgent, 180 degrees opposite to where the sun was located. And thus, when the sun was up during the day, of course, he wouldn't have been visible, but as soon as the sun set, Priyavrata's chariot would appear. And that formed a second sun, so there was no night during this period of time. So, let's see. This is relevant to the whole question of understanding what the earth is in the Bhagavatam, because he was traveling out in space, but he was also traveling on the earth. And he went around Bhumandala seven times, and with the wheels of his chariot, he created seven circular tracks, which became the seven oceans. That formed the seven islands, Saptadvipa. So it's significant that he went around seven times, because it's described that during, his sun created seasons opposite to the seasons of the regular sun. So that during the summer period, his sun created mild and pleasing conditions, and during the winter period, his sun created considerable warmth. That's described in the Bhagavatam. So if you put these different elements together, you can see that when it said that he went around seven times, that means 7 years. So Maharaj Priyavrata was creating the second sun for a period of 7 years, which tells you that the place where he was orbiting corresponds to the ecliptic, or the plane of the sun's orbit. And that's part of the whole process you can follow for understanding where Bhumandala is, as described in the fifth canto of the Bhagavatam. So that is part of the general framework. The point that I was making then, that is the general point, is that if you look at the descriptions in the Bhagavatam from the point of view of modern-day received opinion, based on science and so forth, and you try to make a small adjustment in order to accommodate what is being described there, that won't work. But you can see, if you look at the big picture, how everything fits together. So this description I was giving about Swayambhuva Manu and Priyavrata is part of the big picture. Things were quite a bit different during this historical period than we see now. And one main feature of that period is that these beings were present on the earth who are completely superhuman. So this Kardama Muni also, as I mentioned, was a son of Brahma. So Swayambhuva Manu came to see him. Kardama Muni had been asked by Brahma to create population within the universe. So another feature of the universe is that in the early stages of the creation, there seem to be difficulties in creating sufficient population. We don't seem to have that problem right at the moment. But in any case, Brahma had ordered Kardama Muni to generate population. So Kardama Muni realized that that was his duty. So when Lord Vishnu appeared before him, Kardama Muni asked Lord Vishnu to provide a wife for him. So Svayambhuva Manu, as it turned out, had a very eligible daughter named Devahuti. So he came to see Kardama Muni and arranged for Kardama Muni to marry his daughter. So that was what was happening here. Now here there's a description of, in this purport that I read today, of Kardama Muni. So he had been practicing penances for a very long period of time, but he was in a state of good health. Specifically, this was due to the fact that the Lord Vishnu had glanced upon him. So, let's see what time it is here. So that is very significant. Let's see. Any particular point to make here? Are there any questions or comments? Yeah?
Yeah, just out of curiosity, you mentioned several times that things were quite good in the past. But I thought the general understanding that things were very much the same. Now, another problem is whether there's hardly a mono intense or so maybe you can't see them.
Right. Brahma is there. Yeah, we can't see them. That's another aspect of this whole thing that I could mention. Right now, Manu is not does not have his capital in India between the Jamuna and the Ganges. Now, the fifth canto says where he does have his capital. Now, which Varsh? It's one of the Varshas of Jambudweep. Now, I forget which one. But anyway, Manu is reigning from there. Things were different then in the sense that Manu was directly present in India. But it's a fact, all of these things are going on, so there is a Manu, namely Vaivasvata Manu, right now.